Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Today, we're going to hear a keynote speech delivered by Sandra Steingraber at the Permanent People's Tribunal session on human rights, fracking, and climate change. Sandra is an environmental writer and research biologist who has led the fight against fracking in New York State. This speech was recorded at the Whiteside Theater in Corvallis, Oregon on May 14, 2018.
What an honor to serve as the opening keynote speaker for the historic Permanent People's Tribunal session on human rights, fracking, and climate change. There is this is a convocation many years in the making. Bravo to our hosts, the Spring Creek Project and Oregon State University here in Corvallis, for bringing us together in this elegant Whiteside Theater and via live streaming around the world. With so many good ideas, this week-long series of hearings was inspired by the actions of an extraordinary individual, the philosopher and ethicist, Dr. Tom Kearns, who I hold in highest esteem. Thank you, Tom. As you've heard, the Permanent People's Tribunal is an august international forum. Its origin story is as an investigation of human rights breaches during the war in Vietnam. Since then, its hearings have examined abridgments of human rights standards in Bhopal, India, in the Ukrainian city of Chernobyl, and most recently among the Rohingya and Kachin refugees of Myanmar. Today, we've begun an exploration into the potential human rights violation of a newish technology called unconventional high-volume hydraulic fracturing combined with horizontal drilling, so-called fracking for short. Fracking is what the industry calls it, and fracking is what the enemies of that industry both call it. Fracking is a technology developed at the end of the 20th century in sparsely populated western regions of the United States, using public money from taxpayers. In a line, fracking turns fresh water into a poisonous club to smash apart shale bedrock in order to extract otherwise unattainable bubbles of oil or natural gas, methane, trapped inside of that rock. Fracking has since spread east, west, north, and south, including to the densely populated regions of the Northeast where I live, and to Southern California, and to the breadbasket of Midwestern agricultural regions. The dramatic increase in fracking over the past decade in the United States has pushed oil and gas extraction operations into heavily populated areas. At least 6% of the US population, 17.6 million Americans, now live within a mile of an active oil or gas well. A number that includes 1.4 million children and 1.1 million elderly people. At least 8.6 million people are served by drinking water source located less than a mile from a well pad. These facts alone, along with emerging evidence revealing that fracking sites and associated fracking infrastructure are disproportionately sited in non-white, low-income, and indigenous communities, both in the United States and in countries like Argentina, Mexico, and Canada, where fracking has been exported, means that it is right and necessary to understand the potential for human exposures and accompanying adverse impacts, not only as an issue of public health, but fundamentally as an issue of human rights. My frame for this keynote tonight is the biologist Rachel Carson, whose 1962 book, Silent Spring, about the unintended consequences of pesticides like DDT, sparked a revolution in environmental consciousness and is rightly credited as a founding force of American environmentalism. It was the second great honor of my life this year to edit this new collection of Rachel Carson's environmentalist writings for Library of America, including Silent Spring, but also some never-before-published letters and speeches. And I should say that Library of America exists to canonize iconic American writers and pledges when they collect the writings of an American author and reissue them, that they will be kept in print forever. In this book, Parson makes clear that the environmental crisis is first and foremost a crisis of human rights. And it's that element of her writing that I want to foreground and embrace for our purposes tonight. Parson writes, "If the Bill of Rights contains no guarantee that a citizen shall be secure against lethal poisons distributed by either private individuals or by public officials, it is surely only because our forefathers, despite their considerable wisdom and foresight, could conceive of no such problem." And she went on with, in lyrical descriptive prose, to trace the invisible drift of pesticides from the atmosphere into our rivers, aquifers, breast milk, eggshells of songbirds, and into, finally, the subcellular machinery of our own bodies, creating genetic injuries and blazing trails for cancer, birth defects, and altered development. Her panoramic language that takes us from crop dusters into groundwater and into the nucleus of cells is an artistic exploration in which language becomes a cinematic camera, showing us the connections in the natural world that are otherwise invisible to us. So I want to take a Carsonesque approach tonight and speak to you first as a creative writer and use language as a camera to take you down into the dark heart of the planet, into the bedrock that lies beneath our feet. And I want to rewrite for you as a landscape that this bedrock of our nation is not a void, a lifeless place of inertia, darkness, with oil and gas pocked inside the rock, but rather it is a living ecosystem, a subterranean coral reef, if you will, that is teeming with life, a habitat that is animate and beautiful and is connected to the carbon cycle via metabolizing organisms who live there, and thus is connected to us here at the sunlit surface. Rachel Carson reminds us that wars waged against the web of life will sooner or later transform the cells of our own bodies into battlefields. And this is also true when we turn the weapons of destruction against our nation's bedrock. So let's begin here. 400 million years ago, shallow seas overlay parts of the North American continent. One of them was in the part of the world that I live in the Northeast. And the shallow ocean extended from approximately where the Catskill Mountain Range now is all the way to the middle of Ohio. And I, who live in the Finger Lakes region of upstate New York, would have lived along its northern banks of the sea. The southern reach went all the way into West Virginia. The ocean floor became a graveyard of the organisms who lived here. And remember, 400 million years ago was before fur, before backbones, before 3- and 4-chambered hearts, before breasts, before eyeballs, before fins and flippers. So the organisms we're talking about who lived here were sea lilies, squid, diatoms, and plankton. And when they died, they fell to the bottom of the sea. And that ocean began to fill with silt because it was surrounded by mountains. And as the mountains eroded, they turned into dust. And dust changes its name when it falls into water, and then we call it silt. Mountains are full of entire periodic charts of elements. So as these mountain ranges eroded, the elements drifted with the silt into the bottom of the ocean. These are things like barium, strontium, uranium, lead, mercury. So these elements became part of the floor of these shallow seas. So the organisms died, and they fell to the bottom of the ocean by gravity. But because the Earth's atmosphere wasn't as oxygenated 400 million years ago as it is now, there were not yet land plants. The organisms didn't have enough oxygen to completely decompose, so instead they turned into bubbles of methane, which is carbon with 4 hydrogens. Or a heavier hydrocarbon molecule, something that we would call petroleum or oil. And so not just across the Northeast, but also in North Dakota, in California, in Oklahoma and Texas. These similar oceans existed at similar times, and these phenomenon went on. So eventually then these corpses were covered over by the silt that fell upon them, and they were buried, and eventually then the whole ocean floor petrified and turned from silt into shale. And these organisms were then trapped as bubbles of oil or natural gas inside the rock itself. And they've stayed there like that for 400 million years. Those hydrocarbon bubbles of oil and gas are the quarry of fracking. But these ancient ocean floors that became our shale bedrock are not just a graveyard. They're also a living ecosystem. They're inhabited by living organisms now. Some are bacteria, but many others occupy an ancient domain of life called archaea. And these organisms feed on the hydrocarbons that are down there. They also, some of them, feed on radioactive decay. They're strange. They have, some of them, arsenic instead of phosphorus in their DNA. And now I'm just going to speak to my fellow biologists in the room, and the rest of you can kind of float with this for a minute. They lack electron transport systems, which is very unusual for organisms. We don't see that in living things who live here on the Earth's surface. And the way they can avoid oxidative stress without an electron transport system is that they actually send electrons out into the surrounding rock. They're organized into colonies in order to do this. And they use nanowires to send across themselves a large number of electrons, and thus they alter the rock and change it from one element to another. So I want to pause here for a minute and make a kind of theological or philosophical query. What I'm saying is that the biologic is the creator of the abiotic. These organisms are down there a mile below our feet, making rock, altering it and reshaping it and turning it into something else. And altogether, geologists believe that these deep life organisms by a biomass actually exceed the biomass of living things here on the sunlit surface of our planet. That's why I say we need to think of our bedrock as a kind of subterranean coral reef, another world down there that we may not know much about, but whose destruction and poisoning may have consequences for us. So fracking uses water, 2 to 20 million gallons per frack job, and sends it down into that shale by drilling straight down into it and then turning the drill bit sideways and tunneling like a robotic mole for another mile or more. And first we send down explosives into that tunnel to start fracturing the shale. But what really widens those cracks is water. So fresh drinking water is then sent down the hole. Water is not compressible under high pressure. And you can imagine what kind of pressures are required, because the lithostatic pressure of the earth pressing down on the shale a mile or more of substrate above the shale bedrock, in order to blow that up down there, water has to be under immense amounts of pressure. And if it were only water that was used as the agent for fracking, it wouldn't work, because as soon as you release the pressure to let the gas flow out, all of the fractures that you create, you turn the bedrock into shards at this point. They would all close up again as the weight of the earth presses down upon them. So instead, sand is added to fracking fluid, and not just any kind of sand, but silica sand, because the grains of silica sand are shaped in such a way that they resist crushing under immense pressure. So really, the water is used to create the fractures, but also to shoot the sand grains into the cracks created. And like tiny doorstops, they hold open those spaces so the bubble of oil or gas can then escape and go up the borehole after the pressure is released. But in order to get sand down the hole and around the bend without settling out and clogging the pipe, you need to thicken that water with gelling agents to move the sand around the bend and shoot it into the cracks. So gelling agents are added to fracking fluid, along with things like friction reducers and anti-scaling agents. But those living organisms, those bacteria and those archaea that are down there at that depth, will feed on those gelling agents, and they'll grow inside the pipes and interfere with the flow of gas. And so powerful biocides are added, like glutaraldehyde, to fracking fluid, which is why it's so toxic, because we have to engage in a mass extermination campaign, an underground pesticide spraying program of the bedrock, in order for fracking to work. And some of the water that's used to liberate the bubbles of oil and gas remain trapped within the fractured zone, and as such has now been permanently removed from the hydrologic cycle, forever entombed among the fractured shards. And I want to pause here a moment and ask another philosophical question about humans making water disappear. We've never done that before, to actually remove water from the hydrologic cycle, groundwater that is the mother of rivers that flow to the sea, that evaporate into clouds, that fall as rain or snow and rise again as mist and fog. We've never done that before.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're listening to a speech delivered by environmental writer, research biologist, and anti-fracking activist Sandra Steingraber at the Permanent People's Tribunal session on human rights, fracking, and climate change this past May.
Fresh water is only 1% of all the water available on Earth. Most of it, 98% of it, is seawater. 2% of the Earth's water is fresh water, and half of that is frozen at the poles. So only, that leaves only 1% of water to be part of the living cycle, of which we are all 65% water by weight. So by weight, we are 2/3 raindrops. And so what does it mean that we're making water disappear in a time of a climate crisis, when lack of availability of fresh water is getting more insecure? The water used to fracture shale will never again flow as a river, never again rise as mist, never again rise as sap, never become nectar, attracting bees, never again blood plasma, or breast milk, or tears, or cerebral spinal fluid, or the breath of our exhaled lungs on a cold winter day, or never the snowflakes on that day. Some of the water travels back up to the surface. That's called flowback fluid. And it contains not only the chemical additives that were used to turn the water into fracking fluid, but also it now contains brine, heavy metals, radioactive elements, all those things that were deposited by the eroding of ancient mountain ranges that are now inside the shale, toxic elements that wouldn't hurt anyone as long as they're trapped down below, but now we're going to bring them up to the surface. The result is a massive amount of poisonous liquid waste, and we have a problem with no solution, because no technology exists to turn fracking waste back into drinkable water. It's safe containment is for eternity. It could be reused to frack another well, but not unless it's highly diluted, because the more you use it, the more salty and toxic and corrosive it becomes. So the practice is to inject it in other deep wells where it has been definitively linked to earthquakes, because fracking fluid contains anti-friction agents. Remember, a fracking borehole is only about 5 inches or so in diameter. And to shoot that vast amounts of water with that kind of pressure, you need to reduce the friction. So you make the fracking fluid very slippery. But if you then inject it back down into the earth, it lubricates fault lines and allows rock formations to slip past each other. And that's how earthquakes are generated. We have absolute proof about this link. So this raises to me another ethical question about generational inequity. How is it right that this generation of people alive now can liquidate the bedrock and enjoy the profits from the oil and gas that we blow the bedrock up to extract, and then produce toxic waste which must be curated eternally by our children and grandchildren, who will receive none of the profits? But I want to widen the lens now and take an even bigger view of fracking, because it really doesn't start with the drill bit screwing into the ground. It starts in the upper Midwest with the mining of frack sand. Frack sand mining has now become the number one export of the state of Wisconsin, more than cheese. So Wisconsin is exporting itself, and it's changing its landscape to do that. The coulees and hills and bluff of Wisconsin are disappearing. They're made of sandstone, and that sandstone is made of grains of silica sand that are in high demand for fracking. So you have all these frac sand mining operations going on in Minnesota and Iowa and Wisconsin, in my part of the world in downstate Illinois, where I grew up. Silica sand makes silica dust, and silica dust, like asbestos, is linked to lung cancer. It's also linked to silicosis. So although the people in the upper Midwest live far from the fracking fields, their bedrock is being extracted and blown apart to be carted off to the place in the world where I now live, to be shoved into the ground, to hold open the cracks in the destroyed bedrock of the Northeast, or taken to the fracking fields in the Bakken Shale of North Dakota or Colorado. And then where does the gas go or the oil go after it comes out of the ground? Well, there is a massive amount of infrastructure involved to take that oil and gas from the point of its extraction to wherever the burner tip is. And that takes the form of pipelines and compressor stations and hundreds of underground and above ground gas and oil storage facilities. And here in the Northwest, LNG facilities, where natural gas, through the energy-intensive process of cryogenics, is super chilled, so it can be loaded onto tankers and taken to places where pipelines can't run, such as across the ocean. And of course, the story doesn't end there, because methane leaks at every step of this process. From the moment the drill bit goes into the ground and contacts the shale, methane is pouring out of the hole. It pours out of the valves of every single pipeline, of every single compressor station along the way. And the result is that methane is being loaded into the atmosphere. Methane, 86 times more powerful than carbon dioxide at being able to trap heat in our atmosphere. More methane leaks from fracking operations than we previously appreciated, which means natural gas via fracking is not any cleaner for the climate than coal, and it may be worse. Methane emissions are 20 to 60% higher than previously thought. The ongoing surge in methane levels are now driving climate impacts. And the sharp uptick in global methane levels since 2006 is largely attributable to fossil fuel extraction processes, notably fracking. So let's pause here for a minute and consider these molecules of methane in the atmosphere, and remind ourselves that carbon, when we talk about decarbonizing and loading the atmosphere with carbon, carbon is not the first name for carbon dioxide. Carbon comes in two flavors, carbon dioxide and methane. And these are two naturally occurring components of our Earth that actually make life on Earth possible. So let's just pause for a moment and consider that. So methane comes from dead things. Carbon dioxide is our exhaled breath of all living things. And both of these molecules have the ability, when struck by thermal radiation, which is heat, to vibrate. So when methane and carbon dioxide are in our atmosphere, and then the Earth's surface turns away from the sun at night, the light from the sun, the light energy, entirely vanishes. But the heat energy does not entirely vanish. If it did, it would be like the Disney movie Frozen. Our oceans would turn into ice rinks every night. Our blood plasma would freeze stiff. That doesn't happen because two molecules, methane and CO2, when the sun's heat energy bounces off the surface of the Earth and bounces back into the atmosphere and encounters a molecule of CO2 or methane, those molecules begin to vibrate, and their vibration traps the heat. That's what we mean when we say it's a greenhouse heat-trapping gas. So these vibrational molecules all dancing all night long up in the sky prevent us from dying every night. So the living, the exhaled breath, and the dead, the living and the dead conspire together to make life possible on Earth. So good that we have greenhouse gases. And by the way, of the two molecules, CO2 lasts longer in our atmosphere than methane. Methane is more potent at trapping heat, but it will fall apart after about a decade, whereas CO2 goes on trapping heat for a century, which means your exhaled breath will outlive you. You will be dead and gone, but your breathing, your whole lifetime of breathing, has changed the chemistry of the atmosphere, and those molecules of your exhaled breath, representing all the things you did to metabolize all your life, will go on trapping heat for the people and all the living organisms, all of our relatives, to come after us. And of course, you know, through the miracle of photosynthesis, that some of that CO2 will be taken out of the atmosphere by our friends, the plants, who take them through their stomata of their leaves, remember that in seventh grade, the stomata, and combine them with sunlight and water from the earth up through the roots, and through the miracle of photosynthesis, spin that into sugar and form the beginning of the food chain. So for all of the earth's history, that photosynthesis and the exhaled breath of all the animals have existed in a kind of balance. But 150 years ago, when we exhumed the cemeteries of Devonian animals and plants in this unholy trinity of fossil fuels, oil, coal, and gas, and we lit those bodies on fire in crematoria that we call power plants, we loaded up our atmosphere with 40% more CO2 than pre-industrial levels and almost triple the amount of methane. So now at night, we have many more dancing, vibrating molecules, and it's like a blanket that we can't kick off. And the consequences, as you know, involve melting ice caps, rising seas, and of course the acidification of the ocean, because CO2 turns into carbonic acid when it falls into ocean water. Our plankton stocks are now in trouble because of rising acidity levels and also because of rising surface temperatures of the ocean. Phytoplankton provide us half of the oxygen in our atmosphere. Land plants provide the other half. And so one out of every two breaths we breathe is brought to us by the world's plankton. And if the plankton are in trouble, my friends, we are in trouble as well. And if you're hearing this science for the first time, then that's a failure of my field. If you hear about the falling Dow industrial stocks, but not about the plankton stocks and how they're doing, when you turn on your cell phone every morning or you read the ticker in Times Square, ask why we have a public conversation about economic stocks, but not about ecological stocks, and why aren't scientists having public conversations with us about these issues? So I've talked to you now as a creative writer, and that was my best attempt to use language to create a visual picture for you, both down in this landscape that no one has seen, not even the frackers who are destroying it, and up in the upper reaches of our atmosphere where gases trap heat for us. And now I want to switch things up a bit and talk to you as an activist and tell the story of how we defeated the shale gas army in New York State and won a statewide ban on fracking in 2014. So in 2009, I was invited back to Cornell University, where I had previously been on the faculty, to give a talk on the public health implications of fracking. And I was surprised by the invitation because I didn't know much about fracking then, and I didn't realize the toxic chemicals that were used. And when I discovered they included things like glutaraldehyde and benzene, and that formaldehyde was often released, those are chemicals I know very well from my earlier work. So I went to work investigating it, and I was stunned and shocked by what I learned. And in the summer of 2011, I went across the United States to look at places in the West where fracking was actually happening, to begin some field work on what this actually looked like and what I should be thinking about. I took my kids with me, and we were camping the whole time, so we called it sort of like camping with drill rigs. And it was when I was in Utah interviewing people in the Red Rock community of Utah about proposed fracking operations that I got two phone calls. One was to say that the student Tim DeChristopher was about to be sentenced for his action as a civil disobedient in attempting to stop fracking in the area where I was actually studying. He was going to be sentenced in a federal courtroom in Salt Lake City, and I was asked to come and speak there outside the courtroom while he was being sentenced. So I did. It was my first experience with civil disobedience. So Tim was, for his peaceful actions, that actually did succeed in stopping fracking, He was sentenced to 2 years in federal prison, and he was hauled out of the courtroom by federal marshals in handcuffs and manacles. And then everyone in that area filled the streets during rush hour and simply sat down. And in my mind, there was one image that I couldn't shake, and it was an image of a young woman holding a sign that said, "Climate Justice Now," who sat down on the tracks of the light rail commuter train. And then here came the train full of commuters, and it had to slow and stop. She held her sign. And on the side of the first car of that train was a public service announcement by the American Cancer Society that had a pink ribbon and a slogan that said, "Just get a mammogram." And I thought, well, here it is, my life in public health. Just get a mammogram versus climate justice now. We can either detect problems after they've already arisen, or we can try to prevent them.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're listening to a speech delivered by environmental writer, research biologist, and anti-fracking activist Sandra Steingraber at the Permanent People's Tribunal session on human rights, fracking, and climate change this past May.
The next day, I was back in the field, and I got a phone call from Teresa Heinz Carey letting me know I was the lucky recipient of this year's Heinz Award, which came with this $100,000 check. Had I not just been through what I had been through the day before, I might have thought, oh, what a great windfall. I can use this to do my research. That's what scholars and writers mostly do when these lucky things happen. But instead, I decided I wanted to do climate justice now, not just get a mammogram. And I wanted to use the money not to study fracking, but to stop it. And I had to... I had just heard Tim DeChristopher say to a judge, "I'm not asking for mercy, I'm asking you to join us. This is what love looks like." And so I went back to my unfractured state of New York, and I let it be known that I wanted to somehow unite all of these local groups that were springing up all over trying to stop fracking into a mighty statewide coalition. I didn't know how to do that. I'm just a kind of nerdy biologist. But there were some people who had some political skills, and they included groups like Frack Action, Catskill Mountain Keeper, United for Action, Food and Water Watch. And so there were kind of five groups, plus me, this crazy biologist with a check, and we all kind of pitched in, and we started New Yorkers Against Fracking. We were only this handful of groups at the beginning, but more and more groups joined us, and by the time we banned fracking in 2014, there were more than 400 groups as part of our coalition, and they included Businesses Against Fracking, which itself was a coalition of 1,000 different businesses, Faith Leaders Against Fracking, more than 500 churches and synagogues, and so on. And so we changed the public opinion on fracking, and we took the governor's base away from him. So it now was a bigger problem for him to diss us than it was to diss the oil and gas industry. And as this mighty social movement began unfolding, I was able to retreat and do what I do more comfortably, which is to analyze data. So that's how I became a co-founder of Concerned Health Professionals of New York. We became the scientists in residence to the anti-fracking movement. And we began to analyze the data, to translate the data into plain and simple English, and not only bring it before our state legislatures in testimony and write memoranda for our governor and our commissioner of health and our commissioner of the environment, but also take it to people. Myself and my colleagues in the sciences and medicine spent the better part of 2 years speaking every Friday and Saturday night in a church basement somewhere, in a Rotary Club, in a junior high school auditorium, in a town hall, in a public library. And we gave our fracking 101 PowerPoint presentation. When we started, there were only 65 studies in the peer-reviewed published literature about the risks and harms of fracking. Our goal was to keep the moratorium that we had going. Our feeling was that a moratorium was just a ban with a deadline. And our hunch was that if we could stop fracking for long enough, the data would come in and make it look unthinkable. And that was our strategy. And as we went, we were operating in a moving stream of data. By the time we banned fracking in December 2014, and the governor did announce a ban on the basis that fracking was a demonstrable public health risk, with risks both known and unknown, there were 400 studies in the peer-reviewed literature. Now there are 1,300 studies in the peer-reviewed literature. So we and concerned health professionals of New York continue to edit and bring out new editions of our compendium, which has the very sexy title, Compendium of Scientific, Medical, and Media Findings Demonstrating Risks and Harms of Unconventional Gas and Oil Extraction. And so concerned health professionals of New York, partnering with Physicians for Social Responsibility, who won the Nobel Prize, right, for insisting that nuclear war was unregulatable and needed simply to be abolished. So they were our natural partners in making the same case about fracking. Our first edition of this was so slight we could staple it and mail it to the governor. Now you can see with 1,300 studies, all peer-reviewed and footnoted, it's quite a mighty document. And now we keep bringing out these editions every year to help other states and other nations provide them good data for their own fight. But I guess I want to close this part of my talk off by saying, yes, science won a ban on fracking in New York State, but science alone did not win. If science alone could make good public policy, we would have solved the climate crisis and we would all be using solar power now, right? We had good science on climate at least 20 years ago, if not before. But science together with activism was our winning combination. Activism and social change created the ability for science to speak so that the governor could announce that, yes, the science on fracking was troubling. There were public health risks, and this became the way forward for our state. And so now we're engaged in the process where we're trying to allow the governor to wear the mantle of climate hero, turn our state into an incubator and a laboratory for renewable energy. This is the governor who saw seawater sloshing through our subway system after the 2012 Hurricane Sandy. We want him to play that role for us. At the same time, even though we banned fracking, we haven't yet banned fracking infrastructure. So New York State is still used as a staging grounds where pipelines, compressor stations, natural gas power plants, and gas storage depots are still being built out. My work involves fighting those too. And when we fought against the gas storage facility that took over the salt caverns underneath Seneca Lake, which is where I live and a source of drinking water for 100,000 people, so I'll back up and say a Houston-based gas company bought 5 miles of prime lakefront property, not because it enjoyed the view or loves our wineries, but wanted to get access to the holes in the ground left over by a century of salt mining and use those holes as a gas station for the products of fracking, and so the price could go up before it could put it into pipelines and send it to East Coast markets. Storing gas in what's called interbedded salt and shale formations is one of the most dangerous ways to store gas and has led to fatalities in other states. So we thought that was a bad idea, and we attempted to do for that fight what we were doing with the fracking fight, which is to do really good science on the hydrology of using salt caverns to store compressed gas, the flow of groundwater, how our lake could become salinated, what would happen to the wineries, what would happen to air quality with the flare stacks and all the associated infrastructure. But we failed. In this case, the decider was not our state, but rather the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, who simply said, after all of our testimony and all the work that we had done, we're simply not looking at that, and went ahead and approved the project. So then began a civil disobedience campaign. I decided if you wouldn't listen to my data as a biologist, then you'll listen to my mother's body. I gave birth just down the road from this facility, and my son goes to summer camp not far away, and there's no good evacuation plan. So I'll place my mother's body in between the truck with the drill head and the place where the truck with the drill head wants to go on the driveway of this facility. Over 2.5 years, 650 people felt the same. So we had 650 arrests, and then the company decided to cancel its gas storage expansion plans. There's something about 93-year-old great-grandmothers blocking your driveway that make for really bad press. And I should say that campaign involved a lot more than civil disobedience. It involved municipal ordinances. It involved the Wine Business Coalition petitioning. A lot of things went on behind the scenes. The part for which we got national, international media were the arrests. So civil disobedience is a powerful thing, and I discovered I'm actually good at going to jail. I'm good at going to jail because I'm a good cancer patient. I know how to lie in an MRI machine motionless for 30 minutes. I know how to lie in bed with a heparin lock and an IV drip with a backless blue cotton gown. I know how to push the IV drip down the hallway, holding the back of my blue cotton gown shut with the other hand. And thus, I'm good at shuffling up a set of stairs with ankle manacles and handcuffs. I'm good at being in a cell where the lights are on all night and the food is terrible because it's just like being in a hospital. A hospital has a call button, but they never answer it anyway. Jail cells don't, but what's the difference, right? Probably the most relaxing 2 weeks I've ever spent. So I want to ask you, what would you go to jail for? Would you go to jail for water? To protect water, would you do that? Question for your discernment. Now, lastly, I want to speak to you as a scientist. I've spoken to you as a writer. I've spoken to you as an activist. And now I want to just tell you some of the science of fracking and give you a flavor of this compendium of ours, which has been submitted, by the way, as a testimony for the Fracking Tribunal. And here is how we talk about fracking in this document of ours. Emerging trend number one, growing evidence shows that regulations are simply not capable of preventing harm. Studies reveal inherent problems in the natural gas extraction process, such as well integrity failures caused by aging or the pressures of fracking itself, and in the waste disposal process. These issues can lead to water contamination, air pollution with carcinogens and other toxic chemicals, earthquakes, and a range of environmental and other stressors inflicted on communities. Some of fracking's many component parts, which include the subterranean geological landscape itself, are simply not controllable. Compounding the innate unpredictability of the fracking process, the number of wells and their attendant infrastructure continue to proliferate, creating burgeoning cumulative impacts. The size of individual wells keeps growing, with the horizontal portions of a single well now exceeding as far as 2 miles or more underground. Fluid injections, once typically 3 to 5 million gallons per fracked well, can now easily reach 20 million gallons. The injection of extreme volumes of fluids creates significant deformations in the shale that are translated upward a mile or more to the surface. Along the way, these pressure bulbs can impact in unpredictable ways faults and fissures in the overlying rock strata, including strata that intersect freshwater aquifers. Such pressure bulbs may mobilize contaminants left over from previous drilling and fracking mining operations. No set of regulations can obviate these potential impacts to groundwater. No set of regulations can eliminate earthquake risks. Well sites leak far more methane and toxic vapors than previously understood, and they continue to leak long after they are decommissioned. Abandoned wells are significant sources of methane leakage into the atmosphere. Based on findings from New York and Pennsylvania, they may exceed current total leakage from oil and gas wells currently in production. Plugging abandoned wells does not always reduce methane emissions, and cement plugs themselves deteriorate over time. Further, many abandoned wells are unmapped and their locations unknown. No federal or state agency routinely monitors methane leakage from abandoned wells. Leakage rates among abandoned wells are wildly variable. 4% of wells nationwide are responsible for half of all methane emissions from fracking operations. Predicting which wells will become super emitters is not possible. Further, much of this leakage is engineered into the routine operation of fracking extraction, processing, and transport infrastructure, as when vapors are vented through release valves in order to regulate pressure. Here's another section. Emerging trend number four. Public health problems associated with drilling and fracking include poor birth outcomes, reproductive and respiratory impacts, cancer risks, and occupational health and safety problems. Studies of mothers living near oil and gas extraction operation consistently find impairments to infant health. including elevated risks for low birth weight and preterm birth. A 2017 study that examined birth certificates for 1.1 million infants born in Pennsylvania found poorer indicators of infant health and significantly lower birth weights among babies born to mothers living near fracking sites. A 2015 study found a 40% increase in the risk of preterm birth among infants born to mothers who live nearby drilling sites. A 2014 Colorado study found elevated incidence of neural tube defects and congenital heart defects. New studies in Texas and Colorado found associations with infant deaths, high-risk pregnancies, and low birth weight. A 2017 pilot study in British Columbia found elevated levels of muconic acid, a marker of benzene exposure in the urine of pregnant women living near fracking sites. An emerging body of evidence from both human and animal studies shows harm to fertility and reproductive success from exposure to oil and gas operations, at least some of which may be linked to dozens of known endocrine-disrupting chemicals used in hydraulic fracturing. A 2017 Colorado study found higher incidence of leukemia among children and young adults living in areas dense with oil and gas wells, while a Yale University research team reported that carcinogens involved in fracking operations had the potential to contaminate both air and water in nearby communities in ways that may increase the risk of childhood leukemia. The Yale team identified 55 known or possible carcinogens that may be released into the air and water from fracking operations. Of these, 20 are linked to leukemia. Other documented adverse health indicators among residents living near drilling and fracking operations variously include exacerbation of asthma, increased risks of hospitalization, ambulance runs, emergency room visits, self-reported respiratory problems and rashes, motor vehicle fatalities, trauma, drug abuse, and gonorrhea. Pennsylvania residents with the highest exposure to active fracked gas wells were nearly twice as likely to experience a combination of migraine headache, chronic nasal and sinus symptoms, and severe fatigue. And it goes on.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're listening to a speech delivered by environmental writer, research biologist, and anti-fracking activist Sandra Steingraber at the Permanent People's Tribunal session on human rights, fracking, and climate change this past May.
And now I'm going to let poetry have the last word in honor of the amazing music we heard and the art that exists. I like to say biology and poetry are both about the mystery of being alive. Biology likes to solve the mystery. Poetry simply says, behold. And Kathleen Dean Moore, this is for you, whose writing I've learned so much from. It's a poem for the Marcellus. Marcellus is the name of my bedrock that I live above. And Marcellus, it was named Marcellus because Marcellus is a Roman warrior who got too overconfident and was actually run through by a spear on his own battlefield. And Marcellus also became, for Shakespeare, a character in Hamlet. He's the one that says there's something rotten in the state of Denmark. That's his line. There's also a line in here from Shakespeare, from Julius Caesar. Oh, pardon me, thou bleeding piece of earth, that I am meek and gentle with these butchers. That's iambic pentameter, but the rest of it's written in hip-hop rhythm. Marcellus, below us, Marcellus, below us, Marcellus, tell us, who are you? Older than fishes, older than spinal cord and bone and the green day of trees, older than pollen dust, than seeds, bedrock of grief, subterranean coral reef, microbes and nanowires, electrically inductive hypersaline fires, Marcellus, our cellar, Marcellus, unlike us, fissured and fossiled sarcophagus of sea lilies and squid, ego and id, the whole periodic table in you, uranium, barium, radium, lead, Marcellus, home of the dead, toluene, mercury, benzene, brine, arsenic, the river Styx, 500 million years thick, in you, Eurydice, Hades, Moloch, Charon's boat, Hades, Moloch, ransom note. Marcellus deserved the name given him who waged war and gained fame for the sacking of Syracuse for the Battle of Gaul, only to lose to an enemy and fall at home, no exit plan. Some say your success was embellished. General Marcellus, tell us, who called you the Sword of Rome? Saudi Arabia below our feet, a prolific monster, says Wall Street, a sure thing, a shale play, place your bet. Marcellus, a minor character who guides Hamlet away from his father's ghost. Here, sign this lease and let's make the most of it. Enter now Mark Antony, breaking bread with Bobby Kennedy. Jealous? Et tu, Marcellus. Oh, pardon me, thou bleeding piece of earth, that I am meek and gentle with these butchers. Hades, Moloch, Charon's boat. Oh, pardon me, thou bleeding piece of Hades, Moloch, ransom note. Piece of earth, and I am meek and gentle with these butchers. Marcellus, who are we? Drill, syringe, Derrick Vane, two junkies argue. How many carbon atoms can dance on the head of a pin? Marcellus, quick, tell us. I hear the trucks, they're not far. The plan is to reduce you to rubble. There is no Hubble telescope for you, no 24-hour spill cam for us. Are you a box inscribed with the name Pandora, or a scroll on which is written the names of us all? Holy the rock and the fissure and the salt and the diatoms fall. Holy the unfractured, holy the wall between you and us, Marcellus. Holy the cave, holy the soluble, holy the hall. Holy the unmapped and abandoned well. Hell, I know you're down there. Mom always said, don't blow up the basement. Hades, Moloch, Charon's boat. Hades, Moloch, ransom note. Let me love you from a long way up. Holy the water, holy the cup. Thank you. You guys know how to clap. Thank you. So I've been given the high sign for a few comments and questions, and I can't see you very well. Is there a way to put the house lights up a bit?
Yep, if we can get the house lights up, and I have a mic. If you'd like to raise your hand, I can come to you with if you have a question.
Thank you, and thank you for a wonderful evening and that incredible, incredible gift you've given all of us tonight. My name is Allison Miller. I'm the sister of Tony Flagg. He is the CEO for United Grain, which is a wheat company right out of Vancouver, and it's owned by the Japanese, and they grow wheat in the Northwest, and they have a rail car system that is all their own. And one day my brother called me and says, oh, I'm so excited. I wrote a contract with the fracking company allowing them to use our grain cars to haul their fracking sand when we're not hauling grain. Were you aware of that?
No.
I was floored.
No, I didn't know that. Fracking turns things inside out, not just our bedrock, right? I mean, I can tell you that in 2011, when I went through Texas at the beginning of my study on fracking, there was a terrible heat wave and a drought that summer. It was 109 degrees as I drove through the panhandle. And there were tracking trucks full of water going to the fracking sites, even as the rest of the landscape they were driving through looked like a moonscape of cracked earth with like dead cattle. And people had handwritten signs in their front yards that said, I need water, you haul, I pay. And yet there was still water to take to the fracking site. So I think the reprioritization that fracking has brought, you know, no grain but sand. We're dying from lack of water, but there's water to blow apart the bedrock. This is part of the human rights issue. The abrogation that is fracking in the light of the truth as it now appears to us. That's really clear.
Today, we've been listening to a keynote speech delivered by Sandra Steingraber at the Permanent People's Tribunal session on human rights, fracking, and climate change this past May. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening.
Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground. Turn the ships around. Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground and turn the ships around.
Keep it going.
Cascadia is a place of great power. We stand at the mouth of the river, rooted to the land and its people. We turn the ships around. Cascadia is a place of great power. We stand at the mouth of the river, rooted to the land and its people. We turn the ships around. Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground and turn the ships around. We are a people. We are a people awakening. We are a people reclaiming. We are a people demanding. Turn the ships around. We are a people awakening. We are a people reclaiming. We are a people demanding. Turn the ships around. Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground and turn the ships around.